the principal role of the board members is, you know, basically support and challenge in that order. So basically, if you're constantly challenging, then you've probably got the wrong chairman or the wrong CEO.
Welcome to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany, where business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers. Each episode, we have three items on the agenda: pressure, lessons, and boardroom dynamics. I'm Emily Sheffield, journalist, broadcaster, former newspaper editor, and board member. And I'm looking forward to sitting down with senior leaders to talk about what really goes on behind the boardroom doors when the pressure's on and the stakes are high. Joining me this week is Andy Palmer. Andy is the former chief operating officer at Nissan and the former CEO of the iconic car maker Aston Martin. He has more than 45 years experience in the automotive industry and has been dubbed the godfather of electric vehicles. And in 2012 was voted into the Auto Express Hall of Fame as the most influential British person in the global automotive business. After his time at Aston Martin, he was appointed CEO of the electric bus maker Switch Mobility and later the electrical vehicle charging station provider Podpoint. He sat on boards at numerous companies, from huge multinationals to startups, and is the founder of Palmer Energy Technology, an energy storage company. Welcome to the podcast, Andy.
Thank you for that kind introduction.
So let's kick things off with the first item on our agenda, boardroom pressure. Tell us what it was like when you joined Aston Martin. The company was really struggling. How did you feel when you first walked in to the boardroom?
Well, first of all, I was a proud moment joining Aston Martin. It's a car company that I'd grown up with, and in fact, the head office in the factory is in Gaydon, which is the next village to where I went to school as a 11-year-old. So there was a great deal of pride. I knew a little bit about what I was getting myself into, to be honest. I'd obviously done some due diligence before joining the company, but clearly not enough. And you know, the first 2 weeks, I spent a lot of time talking to customers and dealers, to staff, just walking around and absorbing things. But the most telling meeting I had was with the CFO, and to understand that basically we were going to breach our covenants within the quarter, and that would essentially make us bankrupt. So the idea that I left a really great job at Nissan, had everything bar the CEO title. I'm a product guy, so I was in charge of product principally. But and I moved into this wonderful legendary company, only to be the guy holding the wheel as it goes bankrupt, was a bit startling. So that's pressure. That's boardroom pressure.
I'd just like to go back to that first board meeting again. Just, you know, advice for some of our listeners. When you walked into that first boardroom, you know, you're the new CEO. You know, at this point, you're sort of facing bankruptcy within a few months. How much weight did you add to your opening remarks? You know, how did you bring the board onto your side?
You've got to be confident, right? So even if you don't necessarily feel it inside, outwardly you need to project. You need to be empathetic. In other words, those people around the table need to garner and support you. So you've got to project it, not in an accusational way. I mean, I could have got, I suppose, accusational. You didn't tell me this. But what I did was go in a very matter-of-fact way, so presented the fact, the weight, the gravity of the situation, and the plan of what I was going to do to turn it around. But you have to present it as just move out my way, essentially, and let me get on with this, and I'll report to you every week.
And you launched the DBX SUV, which did that face some resistance internally, and why was there resistance, and how did you overcome that?
Internally and externally, well, first of all, from the very get go, I was convinced, and I think I'm proven correct now, that the company needed a 4x4, basically an SUV. it needed it, apart from anything else. I think if I remember the statistic right, 74% of our customers had an SUV in their garage. The problem was it wasn't an Aston SUV. Generally speaking, the board was more supportive, but at one moment, my board at the time was split into two types of shareholders. There was an Italian shareholder and there was a Kuwaiti shareholder. Both had recruited me on the basis that my premise was you're going to need an SUV. But at one of my first product planning meetings, the Kuwaiti side of the table raised some doubt. And so we went back to the starting point, which is very clearly the argument of fact, the trend, the argument of profitability, and then the very, I would say, hard logic of how we can do something that keeps the values of the brand but brings it to a different type of vehicle. So the mandate for DBX was, how do you make the most beautiful SUV in the world? Because Aston makes the most beautiful cars in the world. Whether we achieved it or not, that's up to you to decide, not for me.
And so the sort of learnings I'm hearing from that is that at the end of the day, to persuade your board, you always went back to research, data, facts, and then presented those as the arguments, not... And alongside that, how much did your experience matter when you gave those arguments? Because I assume there was quite a lot of the board that were leaning into your experience.
Yes, you'd like to think that was why they'd recruited me. And of course, over a period of time, Aston became profitable for the very first time in its 110-year history. So that also buys you a certain amount of credibility. And you're obviously building trust with people so that as you go on to the next hard thing, investment in the DBX plant, that was a new factory. That was a big commitment for the company. The shareholders at the boardroom, it was quite difficult because we had, as I said, two different types of shareholders. And I had to do quite a lot of, let me use the Japanese word because I don't find a better word for it. It's called nemawashi. Nemawashi means more or less pre-discussion. So you, in a typical, more confrontational Western board, you take the problem into the meeting. In a Eastern type of board, you have the discussions outside of the meeting beforehand, and you get a certain amount of consensus going in. So you sort of know where everybody's coming from. You've sort of basically negotiated a settlement, and the board meeting becomes a little bit more ceremonial in that respect, a bit smoother because everybody knows where they're coming from. So you can call it empathetic if you want, but basically I found that I spent a lot of time on the phone before board meetings, making sure that I got each of the players nominally on board in the direction that I wanted to go.
We're going to move now to agenda sort of number two, which is lessons. And I guess some of the biggest board lessons you've learned, you've just touched on that, is that there are these two very different ways of handling board meetings.
My mind, any board, the principal role of the board members is, basically support and challenge in that order. So basically, if you're constantly challenging, then you've probably got the wrong chairman or the wrong CEO. So generally speaking, the predisposition should be to support. That doesn't mean simply abdicate. It does mean, for example, in my way of running a board, that you have to have the papers with the board members at least the weekend before the board meeting so that people can thoroughly read it. It does mean that your non-executive directors need to be the type of people that properly prepare themselves for a meeting. It does mean that your chairman, I've obviously acted many times as chairman, but that you as chairman are talking to all the board members beforehand to make sure that they've understood. It doesn't stop a robust discussion. It doesn't stop some challenges or some clarifications. But what it does allow the chairman to do is, if you know that you're going to have conflict, I mean, it doesn't stop the conflict if that's where it needs to go, but it does at least allow you as chairman to orchestrate the conversations to make sure that they're not becoming emotional. Emotional discussions don't work, right? So you're in a boardroom. It's a business environment, and you've got to make logical choices. What you don't want is people slamming the tables and throwing in their resignations and everything that goes with that. So I think one of the main principles that a chairman can do is to keep it rational, keep it calm, but allow the flow of the conversation so that it's a fulsome discussion. But as a chairman, you should have a pretty good idea what the outcome is going to be, because you should have already pre-discussed it, at least in my world.
And I think it's really interesting that you've been on so many boards, and you've been chair and CEO, but you've done huge multinational companies like Nissan, but you've also sat on loads of boards at startups. How do you compare those two, and what are the similarities and what are the differences?
You know what, I think every FTSE chairman should sit also on a startup, because you're looking at a problem in a very different way. You know, as I give you some examples, you know, the marketing budget that I was responsible for at Nissan was $4 billion a year. $4 billion. Okay. At Aston when I joined, the budget was $10 million. So a fraction. And at some of my startups, it's frankly a few thousand pounds. There's no doubt that you can often do a lot with amounts of money that you don't believe is possible. And you know, in reflection, I wish I'd known that when I was at Nissan. In the same way that I wish I'd known some of the things I learned about engineering cars in carbon fiber, which would have been very useful had I been at Nissan. So experience is you know, it's the most valuable thing that you can have as a senior leader, somewhere to go and look, somewhere, if you will, to draw combined wisdoms from different types of places. And sitting as a nerd on a board, and again, if you're just sitting on a board that's like your board, no big meaning. But if you're looking at diversity, and particularly in some of the venture space, which is really, really innovative, and you'd be amazed what you can get done with a few clever people, I think it inspires you into the way that you work in your own company. So I do think looking at the spectrum of different types of companies is really interesting. Now, you know, my latter parts of my career since developing the Nissan Leaf have all focused around transportation to net zero. So when I look at boards, I'm not just looking at the broad experience of small and large. I'm also looking at different facets of the journey to net zero, zero well to wheel, as I would call it. And so, you know, working with Pod Point, the point there was that it's 54% owned by EDF, the energy company. So you can look at the way of moving cars around from an energy point of view. When I look at somewhere like Brill Power, I can look at it from the electronics and software point of view of a battery, or somewhere like Inabat, where I can look at it from the chemistry point of view. So what you're doing is you're learning far more than you can just in one company, because you're looking at a problem from different perspectives. And one hopes that simply makes you a wiser person and able to make more fact-informed decisions, because you've got a better knowledge of the problem.
Agenda number three, our final one, which is boardroom dynamics. And let's go back and talk about the launch of Nissan Leaf. You were responsible for it. It was the first mass market zero emissions vehicle, but it didn't have universal support within Nissan, did it? So
no.
Again, you know, you've touched on this in more sort of Japanese way of dealing with the board. I'm assuming you were on the telephone quite a lot talking people through.
Well, you know, sometimes you can do as much nemawashi as you want. Remember the Japanese word of pre-discussion. But sometimes you'll not get everybody agreed. And then it becomes a force of will. And that was the case with Leaf. We, at the time, obviously Nissan's major competitor is a company called Toyota. And you might remember in the late 90s, there was a product, which still exists today, called the Prius. Prius is a hybrid. And it was loved by the celebrities because it was obviously good, you know, better for the planet. And, you know, we were seeing everybody drive.
Leonardo DiCaprio was an early adopter, wasn't
Leonardo
he?
Leonardo DiCaprio was the guy that was the poster boy for the Prius. And Toyota were kicking our ass, honestly, because we didn't have one. And so the sales, the clearly the sales and marketing department, which worked for me, were shouting that we need the Nissan Prius. Fortunately, when I first moved to Japan, I'd been responsible for light commercial vehicles. And oddly, because it was also loss-making, I'd been responsible for a Californian compliance vehicle, which was an electric vehicle. So I'd had access to the technology that the engineers in Atsugi, which is where Nissan's R&D is based, I'd had access to all of that technology. And so in looking at the problem, and the problem was that Toyota was just running away with the market, it seemed to me that simply copying Toyota was the wrong way to go. And that what we needed to do was we needed to leapfrog. We needed to go in a different direction. And so drawing on that experience and my knowledge, first of all, I won the support of the head of engineering. Obviously, he was keen to demonstrate his engineering acumen and proud of what they'd done. So that was first supporter. And we went to our CEO at the time, a guy called Carlos Ghosn, and persuaded him that this was the way to go. As you do, you play all of the arguments, and one of those arguments, of course, was playing to the CEO's ego, which was, Mr. Ghosn, you can be a hero here. You can be the first to introduce this kind of technology. You'll go down in history. He went down in history for other reasons, but that whole argument of looking for different ways of garnering support, looking for people's particular weakness, if you want, of why they would give you that support. And to be honest, we would never have got Leaf to market had it not been for the unwavering support of Carlos Ghosn.
So you got air cover from him. Was he the first person you knew you had to turn on that board? Did he then ring members of the board for you? Was he very active in supporting you?
He was very verbal in supporting. Carlos Ghosn was a master of press. So he quite often used the press ahead of talking to the company. And I know that sounds a bit strange, but if you've told somebody outside you're going to do something, then it's difficult for anybody inside to then say something to the contrary. So he was very visible outside talking about the electric car. He was very powerful in the boardroom. And you had to be brave to stand up to basically argue an opposite opinion. But clearly there were three regional heads in the room and a CFO that very, very, very clearly did not support Leaf because it was a very, very unprofitable car. So their argument was worth listening to, and it was good pressure, but it didn't change the fact that this was a long-term play to, you know, at that time, basically to win this sector of the market, to change the perception of the Nissan brand, for Nissan brand to live its brand tagline of innovation that excites. Extremely innovative and extremely exciting. So it was about putting marketing first. And of course, that waned on the power of the regions, which in a Nissan world were very, very powerful, because they were the ones basically making the money, making the profitable vehicles. So it was for 4 years or so. It was an interesting journey, and I think it's interesting that basically the board meeting after I left, that started to unravel, and Nissan ultimately lost its leadership in EVs. I think partially because I, as the sponsor, what wasn't therefore there to face down the descenders, and it can make a big difference. To you need somebody. Sometimes they're the fall guy, but you do need, and any kind of technological change, you do need a sponsor. And you do need a champion. And Ghosn was my sponsor, and I guess I was the champion.
We always finish with one final question. If you could go back to your first ever board meeting, what would you tell yourself? And if you could tell us what that first board meeting was and who with?
I guess I attended a lot of board meetings at Nissan, but the first one where I was the key center of focus was my first Aston Martin board meeting when I was the CEO. My 21st birthday, my father regrettably never got to see me at the helm of Aston Martin. But my father and my mother bought me an attaché case, a leather briefcase. And my dad typed a letter to me and signed it Mom and Dad, which was basically, this is 21 years old, take this briefcase to your first board meeting. And I did. I did because I was nervous. I was scared. Big deal. Did I make the right decision coming to the company? Am I good enough? And I think back to be more self-confident. That by that time, I had done enough in my career to be the best guy in the room to lead the company going forward. And sometimes when you move into a new job, when you become the CEO of a company, it's, they say it, right? It's a very lonely job. It is a very lonely job because there's no one you can talk to. All things eventually rest on your shoulders. But for anybody that's going into that role, people don't select their CEOs lightly. You're there because people can see that you're the best man or woman for the job. And I think anybody going into their board meeting needs to have that self-confidence. That doesn't mean be cocky. It doesn't mean be self-assured. It does mean having confidence because people are looking to you to have that confidence, to give them the reassurance that they made the right choice.
Andy Palmer, thank you so much for sharing your boardroom stories with us and giving us your time and commitment. You've been listening to Boardroom Confidential, a podcast by Sherpany. Sherpany is a leading meeting management solution designed to meet the unique needs of the board, board committee, and executive meetings. Find out more at sherpany.com. And make sure you subscribe to the Boardroom Confidential podcast to hear more business leaders tell the stories they usually only share with their peers.